being away, but they don't look anything alike.
You're telling me, I said. But Arnie isn't much like he used to be either. And it all goes back to that goddamn car. I poked savagely at the square of plaster on the left. That isn't his signature. I've known Arnie almost all my life. I've seen his homework papers. I've seen him send away for things. I've watched him endorse his paychecks, and that is not his signature. The one on the right, yes. This one, no. You want to do something for me tomorrow, Lee?
What?
I told her. She nodded slowly.
For us.
Huh?
I'll do it for us, because we have to do something, don't we?
Yes, I said. I guess so. You mind a personal question? She shook her head, her remarkable blue eyes never leaving mine. How have you been sleeping lately?
Not so well, she said. Bad dreams. How about you?
No, not so good. And then, because I couldn't help myself anymore, I put my hands on her shoulders and kissed her. There was a momentary hesitation, and I thought she was going to draw away. Then her chin came up, and she kissed me back, firmly and fully. Maybe it was sort of lucky at that, me being mostly immobilized. When the kiss was over, she looked into my eyes, questioning.
Against the dreams, I said,
thinking it would come out stupid and phony smooth, the way it looks on paper, but instead it sounded shaky and almost painfully honest.
Against the dreams,
she repeated gravely, as if it were a talisman. And this time she inclined her head toward me, and we kissed again, with those two ragged squares of plaster staring up at us like blind white eyes, with Arnie's name written across them. We kissed for the simple animal comfort that comes with animal contact. Sure, that. And something more. Starting to be something more. And then we held each other without talking. And I don't think we were kidding ourselves about what was happening. At least, not entirely. It was comfort. But it was also good old sex. Full, ripe, and randy with teenage hormones. And maybe it had a chance to be something fuller and kinder than just sex. There was something else in those kisses. I knew it, she knew it, and probably you do too. That other thing was a shameful sort of betrayal. I could feel 18 years of memories cry out. The ant farms, the chess games, the movies, the things he had taught me, the times I had kept him from getting killed. Except maybe in the end, I hadn't. Maybe I had seen the last of him. And a poor, ragtag end at that on Thanksgiving night, when he brought me the turkey sandwiches and beer. I don't think it occurred to either of us that until then, we had done nothing unforgivable to Arnie. Nothing that might anger Christine. But now, of course, we had. Chapter 44. Detective Work. What happened in the next 3 weeks or so was that Lee and I played detective. And we fell in love. She went down to the municipal offices the next day and paid 50 cents to have two papers Xeroxed. Those papers go to Harrisburg, but Harrisburg sends a copy back to the town. This time, my family was home when Lee arrived. Ellie peeked in on us whenever she got the chance. She was fascinated by Lee, and I was quietly amused when, about a week into the new year, she started wearing her hair tied back as Lee did. I was tempted to get on her case about it and withstood the temptation. Maybe I was growing up a little bit, but not enough to keep from sneaking one of her yodels when I saw one hidden behind the Tupperware bowls of leftovers in the refrigerator. Except for Ellie's occasional peeks, we had the living room mostly to ourselves that next afternoon, the 27th of December, after the social amenities had been observed. I introduced Lee to my mother and father, my mom served coffee, and we talked. Elaine talked the most, chattering about her school and asking Lee all sorts of questions about ours. At first I was annoyed, and then I was grateful. Both my parents are the soul of middle-class politeness. If my mom was being led to the electric chair and bumped into the chaplain, she would excuse herself. And I felt pretty clearly that they liked Lee, but it was also obvious, to me at least, that they were puzzled and a little uncomfortable, wondering where Arnie fit into all this. Which was what Lee and I were wondering ourselves, I guess. Finally, they did what parents usually do when they're puzzled in such situations. They dismissed it as kid business and went about their own business. Dad excused himself first, saying that his workshop in the basement was in its usual post-Christmas shambles, and he ought to start doing something about it. Mom said she wanted to do some writing. Ellie looked at me solemnly and said, "Dennis, did Jesus have a dog?" I cracked up, and so did Ellie. Lee sat watching us laugh, smiling politely the way outsiders do when it's a family joke. "Split, Ellie," I said. "What do you do if I won't?" she asked, but it was only routine brattiness. She was already getting up. "Make you wash my underwear?" I said. "The hell you will," Ellie declared grandly, and left the room. "My little sister," I said. Lee was smiling. "She's great. If you had to live with her full time, you might change your mind. Let's see what you got." Lee put one of the Xerox copies on the glass coffee table where the pieces of my casts had been yesterday. It was the re-registration of a used car. 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1, 1978, and signed Arnold Cunningham. His father had co-signed for him. Signature of owner, Arnold Cunningham. Signature of parent or guardian if owner is under 18, Michael Cunningham. "What does that look like to you?" I asked. "One of the signatures on one of the squares you showed me," she said. "Which one?" "It's the way he signed just after I got crunched in Ridge Rock," I said. "It's the way his signature always looked." "Now let's see the other one." She put it down beside the first. This was a registration slip for a new car. 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1, 1957. I felt a nasty jolt at that exact similarity, and one look at Lee's face told me she had seen it too.
"Look at the signature,"
she said quietly. I did.
Signature of owner, Roland D. LeBay. This was the handwriting Arnie had used on Thanksgiving evening. You didn't have to be a genius or a handwriting expert to see that. The names were different, but the writing was exactly the same.
Lee reached for my hands, and I took hers. What my father did in his basement workshop was make toys. I suppose that might sound a little weird to you, but it's his hobby. Or maybe something more than a hobby. I think there might have been a time in his life when he had to make a difficult choice between going to college and going out on his own to become a toy maker. If that's true, then I guess he chose the safe way. Sometimes I think I see it in his eyes, like an old ghost not quite laid to rest, but that is probably only my imagination, which used to be a lot less active than it is now. Ellie and I were the chief beneficiaries, but Arnie had also found some of my father's toys under various Christmas trees and beside various birthday cakes, as had Ellie's closest childhood friend, Amy Carruthers, long since moved to Nevada, and now referred to in the doleful tones reserved for those who have died young and senselessly, and many other chums. Now my dad gave most of what he made to the Salvation Army 400 Fund, and before Christmas the basement always reminded me of Santa's workshop. Until just before Christmas, it would be filled with neat cardboard cartons containing wooden trains, little tool chests, erector-set clocks that really kept time, stuffed animals, a small puppet theater or two. His main interest was in wooden toys. Up until the Vietnam War, he had made battalions of toy soldiers. But in the last 5 years or so, they had been quietly phased out. Even now, I'm not sure he was aware he was doing it. But like a good spray hitter, my dad went to all fields. During the week after Christmas, there was a hiatus. The workshop would seem terribly empty, with only the sweet smell of sawdust to remind us that the toys had ever been there. In that week, he would sweep, clean, oil his machinery, and get ready for next year. Then, as the winter wore on through January and February, the toys and the seeming junk that would become parts of toys would begin appearing again. trains and jointed wooden ballerinas with red spots of color on their cheeks, a box of stuffing raked out of someone's old couch that would later end up in a bear's belly. My father called every one of his bears Owen or Olive. I had worn out 6 Owen bears between infancy and second grade, and Ellie had worn out a like number of Olive bears. Little snips of wire, buttons, and flat disembodied eyes scattered across the work table like something out of a pulp horror story. Last, the liquor store boxes would appear, and the toys would again be packed into them. In the last 3 years, he had gotten 3 awards from the Salvation Army, but he kept them hidden away in a drawer, as if he was ashamed of them. I didn't understand it then, and don't now. Not completely. But at least I know it wasn't shame. My father had nothing to be ashamed of. I worked my way down that evening after supper, clutching the banister madly with one arm and using my other crutch like a ski pole.
"Dennis," he said, pleased but slightly apprehensive.
"You need any help?"
"No, I got it."
He put his broom aside by a small yellow drift of shavings and watched to see if I was really going to make it.
"How about a push, then?"
"Ha ha, very funny." I got down, semi-hopped over to the big easy chair my father keeps in the corner beside our old Motorola black and white, and sat down. Plonk.
"How you doing?"
he asked.
"Pretty good."
He brushed up a dustpan full of shavings, dumped them into his waste barrel, sneezed, and brushed up some more.
"No pain?"
"No, well, some."
"You want to be careful of stairs. If your mother had seen what you just did..."
I grinned. "She'd scream, yeah."
"Where is your mother?"
"She and Ellie went over to the Renickies. Dinah Renicky got a complete library of Sean Cassidy albums for Christmas. Ellie is green."
"I thought Sean was out,"
my father said. "I think she's afraid fashion might be doubling back on her." Dad laughed. Then there was a companionable silence for a while. Me sitting, him sweeping. I knew he'd get around to it. And presently he did.
"Lee," he said, "used to go with Arnie, didn't she?"
"Yes," I said. He glanced at me, then down at his work again. I thought he would ask me if I thought that was wise, or maybe mention that one fellow stealing another fellow's girl was not the best way to promote continued friendship and accord. But he said neither of those things.
"We don't see much of Arnie anymore. You suppose he's ashamed of the mess he's in?"
I had the feeling that my father didn't believe that at all, that he was simply testing the wind.
"I don't know," I said. "I don't think he has much to worry about, with Darnell dead."
He tipped his dustpan into the barrel, and the shavings slid in with a soft flump.
"I doubt if they'll even bother to prosecute."
"No?"
"Not Arnie. Not on anything serious. He may be fined, and the judge will probably lecture him, but nobody wants to put an indelible black mark on the record of a nice young suburban white boy who was bound for college and a fruitful place in society."
He shot me a sharp, questioning look, and I shifted in the chair, suddenly uncomfortable.
"Yeah, I suppose."
"Except he's not really like that anymore. Is he, Dennis?"
"No, he's changed."
"When was the last time you actually saw him?"
"Thanksgiving."
"Was he okay then?"
I shook my head slowly, suddenly feeling like crying and blurting it all out. I had felt that way once before and hadn't. I didn't this time either, but for a different reason. I remembered what Lee had said about being nervous for her parents on Christmas Eve, and it seemed to me now that the fewer the people who knew about our suspicions, the safer. For them.
"What's wrong with him?"
"I don't know."
"Does Lee?"
"No, not for sure. We have some suspicions."
"Do you want to talk about them?"
"Yes, in a way I do, but I think it would be better if I didn't."
"All right," he said. "For now."
He swept the floor. The sound of the hard bristles on the concrete was almost hypnotic.
"And maybe you had better talk to Arnie before too much longer?"
"Yeah, I was thinking about that."
But it wasn't an interview I looked forward to. There was another period of silence. Dad finished sweeping and then glanced around.
"Looks pretty good, huh?"
"Great, Dad."
He smiled a little sadly and lit a Winston. Since his heart attack, he had given the butts up almost completely, but he kept a pack around, and every now and then he'd have one, usually when he felt under stress.
Bullshit. It looks empty as hell.
Well, yeah.
You want a hand upstairs, Dennis?
I got my crutches under me. I wouldn't turn it down.
He looked at me and snickered.
Long John Silver. All you need is the parrot.
Are you going to stand there giggling or give me a hand?
Give you a hand, I guess.
I slung an arm over his shoulder, feeling somehow like a little kid again. It brought back almost forgotten memories of him carrying me upstairs to bed on Sunday nights after I started to doze off halfway through the Ed Sullivan show. The smell of his aftershave was just the same. At the top, he said,
Step on me if I'm getting too personal, Denny, but Lee's not going with Arnie anymore, is she?
No, Dad.
Is she going with you?
I don't really know. I guess not.
Not yet, you mean?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I was starting to feel uncomfortable and it must have showed, but he pushed on anyway.
Would it be fair to say that maybe she broke it off with Arnie because he wasn't the same person anymore?
Yes, I think that would be fair to say.
Does he know about you and Lee?
Dad, there's nothing to know. At least, not yet. He cleared his throat, seemed to consider, and then said nothing. I let go of him and worked at getting my crutches under me. I worked a little harder at it than I had to, maybe.
I'll give you a little gratuitous advice, my father said, finally. Don't let him know what's between you and her. And never mind the protestations that there isn't anything. You're trying to help him some way, aren't you?
I don't know if there's anything either Lee or I can do for Arnie, Dad.
I've seen him 2 or 3 times,
my father said.
You have?
I said, startled. Where? My father shrugged.
On the street, downtown, you know. Libertyville's not that big, Dennis.
He what?
Hardly seemed to recognize me. And he looks older. Now that his face is cleared, he looks much older. I used to think he took after his father, but now...
He broke off suddenly.
Dennis, has it occurred to you that Arnie may be having some sort of nervous breakdown?
Yes, I said, and only wished I could have told him that there were other possibilities.
Worse ones. Possibilities that would have made my old man wonder if I was the one having a nervous breakdown. You be careful, he said.
And although he didn't mention what had happened to Will Darnell, I suddenly felt strongly that he was thinking of it.
You be careful, Dennis.
Lee called me on the telephone the next day and said that her father was being called away to Los Angeles on year-end business and had proposed on the spur of the moment that they all go along with him and get away from the cold and the snow. My mother was crazy about the idea, and I just couldn't think of any plausible reason to say no, she said. It's only 10 days, and school doesn't start again until January 8th.
It sounds great, I said. Have fun out there.
You think I should go?
If you don't, you ought to have your head examined.
Dennis?
What?
Her voice dropped a little. You'll be careful, won't you? I've been thinking about you a lot lately.
She hung up then, leaving me feeling surprised and warm. But the guilt remained, fading a little now maybe, but still there.
My father had asked me if I was trying to help Arnie. Was I? Or was I maybe only snooping into a part of his life which he'd expressly marked off-limits, and stealing his girl in the process? And what exactly would Arnie do or say if he found out? My head ached with questions, and I thought that maybe it was just as well that Lee was going away for a while. As she herself had said about our folks, it seemed safer. On Friday the 29th, the last business day of the old year, I called the Libertyville American Legion post and asked for the secretary. I got his name, Richard McCandless, from the building's janitor, who also found a telephone number to go with it. The number turned out to be that of David Emerson's, Libertyville's good furniture store. I was told to wait a moment, and then McCandless came on, a deep, gravelly voice that sounded a tough 60, as if maybe Patton and the owner of this voice had fought their way across Germany to Berlin shoulder to shoulder, possibly biting enemy bullets out of the air with their teeth as they went.
"McCandless," he said.
"Mr. McCandless, my name is Dennis Gilder. Last August, you put on a military-style funeral for a fellow named Roland LeBay."
"Was he a friend of yours?"
"No, only a bare acquaintance, but..."
"Then I don't have to spare your feelings none,"
McCandless said, gravel rattling in his throat. He sounded like Andy Devine, crossed with Broderick Crawford.
"LeBay was nothing but a pure D. Sandy Cross son of a bitch, and if I'd had my way, the Legion wouldn't have had a thing to do with planning him. He quit the organization back in 1970. If he hadn't quit, we would have fired him. That man was the most contentious bastard that ever lived."
"Was he?"
"You bet he was. He'd pick an argument with you, then up it to a fight if he could. You couldn't play poker with the son of a bitch, and you sure couldn't drink with him. You couldn't keep up with him for one thing, and he'd get mean for another. Not that he had to go far to get mean. What a crazy bastard he was. You should pardon my Francaise. Who are you, boy?"
For an insane instant, I thought of quoting Emily Dickinson at him. "I'm nobody. Who are you?" "A friend of mine bought a car from LeBay just before he died."
"Shit. Not that 57.
"Well, actually, it was a 58.
Yeah, 57 or 58, red and white. That was the only goddamn thing he cared about. Treated it like it was a woman. It was over that car that he quit the Legion. Did you know that?"
"No," I said. "What happened?"
"Ah, shit. Ancient history, kid. I'm bending your ear as it is, but every time I think of that son of a bitch LeBay, I see red. I still got the scars on my hands. Uncle Sam had 3 years of my life during World War II, and I never got so much as a Purple Heart out of it, although I was in combat almost all that time. I fought my way across half the little shitpot islands in the South Pacific. Me and about 50 other guys stood up to a bonsai charge on Guadalcanal. 2 fucking million Japs coming at us, hot to the eyeballs and waving those swords they made out of Maxwell House coffee cans, and I never got a scar. I felt a couple of bullets go right by me. Just before we broke that charge, the guy next to me got his guts rearranged, courtesy of the Emperor of Japan. But the only times I saw the color of my own blood over there in the Pacific was when I cut myself shaving. Then,"
McCandless laughed,
"shit on toast. There I go again. My wife says I'll open my mouth too wide someday and just fall right in. What'd you say your name was?"
"Dennis Gilder."
"Okay, Dennis, I bent your ear. Now you bend mine. What did you want?"
"Well, my friend bought that car and fixed it up for sort of a street rod, I guess you'd say a showpiece."
"Yeah, just like LeBay,"
McCandless said, and my mouth went dry.
"He loved that fucking car, I'll say that for him. He didn't give a shit for his wife. You know what happened to her?"
"Yes," I said.
"He drove her to it,"
McCandless said grimly.
"After their kid died, she didn't get any comfort from him at all, none. I don't think he gave much of a shit about the kid, either. Sorry, Dennis, I never could shut up. Talk all the time, always have. My mother used to say, 'Dickie, your tongue's hung in the middle and runs on both ends.' What did you say you wanted?"
"My friend and I went to LeBay's funeral," I said, "and after it was over, I introduced myself to his brother."
"He seemed like a right enough type,"
McCandless broke in.
"Schoolteacher, Ohio."
"That's right. I had a talk with him, and he did seem like a nice enough guy. I told him I was going to do my senior English paper on Ezra Pound."
"Ezra who?"
"Pound."
"Who the fuck's that? Was he at LeBay's funeral?"
"No, sir. Pound was a poet."
"A what?"
"Poet. He's dead, too."
"Oh."
McCandless sounded doubtful. "Anyway, LeBay, this is George LeBay. He said he'd send me a bunch of magazines about Ezra Pound for my report if I wanted them. Well, it turns out that I could use them, but I forgot to get his address. I thought you might have it."
"Sure. It'll be in the records. All that stuff is. I hate being fucking secretary, but my year's up this July, and never again, know what I mean? Never fucking again."
"I hope I'm not being a real pain in the ass."
"No, hell no. I mean, that's what the American Legion's for, right? Help people. Give me your address, Dennis, and I'll send you a card with the info on it."
I gave him my name and address and apologized again for bothering him at his job.
"Think nothing of it," he said. "I'm on my fucking coffee break anyhow."
I had a moment to wonder just what it was he did at David Emerson's, which really was where Libertyville's elite bought. Was he a salesman? I could see him showing some smart young lady around, saying, "Here's one fuck of a nice couch, ma'am, and look at this goddamn settee.
We sure didn't have nothing like that on Guadalcanal when those fucking stoned-out Japs came at us with their Maxwell House swords."
I grinned a little, but what he said next sobered me quickly.
"I rode in that car, LeBay's, a couple of times. I never liked it. I'll be damned if I know why, but I never did. And I never would ride in it after his wife, you know. Jesus, that gave me the spooks."
"I'll bet," I said, and my voice seemed to come from far away. "Listen, what did happen when he quit the Legion? You said it had something to do with the car." He laughed, sounding a little pleased.
"You're not really interested in all that ancient history, are you?"
"Well, yeah, I am. My friend bought the car, remember?"
"Well, then I'll tell you. It was a pretty funny goddamn thing at that. A few of the guys mention it from time to time, when we've all had a few. I ain't the only one with scars on my hands. Getting right down to the bottom of it, it was sort of spooky."
"What was?"
"Oh, it was a kid's trick, but nobody really liked the son of a bitch, you know? He was an outsider, a loner."
"Like Arnie," I thought.
"And we'd all been drinking," McCandless finished. "It was after the meeting, and LeBay had been making an even worse prick of himself than usual. Saw a bunch of us were at the bar, you know, and we could tell LeBay was getting ready to go home. He was getting his jacket on and arguing with Poochie Anderson about some baseball question. When LeBay went, he always went the same way, kid. He'd jump into that Plymouth of his, back up, and then floor it. That thing would go out of the parking lot like a rocket, spraying gravel everywhere. So this was Sonny Bellerman's idea. About four of us go out the back door to the parking lot while LeBay's shouting at Poochie. We all get behind the far corner of the building because we know that's where he'll finish backing the car up before he takes off. He always called it by a girl's name. I told you it was like he was married to the fucking thing. 'Keep your eyes open and your heads down or he'll see us,' Sonny says, 'and don't move until I give you a go.' We were all sort of tanked up, you know. So about 10 minutes later, out he comes, drunk as a skunk and feeling around in his chinos for his keys. Sonny says, 'Get ready, you guys, and keep low.' LeBay gets in the car and backs her up. It was perfect, because he stopped to light a cigarette. While he did that, we grabbed the back bumper of that Fury and we lifted the rear wheels right off the ground, so that when he tries to pull out, spraying gravel all over the side of the building like usual, you know, he's only gonna spin his wheels and not go anywhere, you see what I mean?"
"Yeah," I said. "It was a kid's trick. We had pulled the same thing from time to time at school dances, and once, for a joke, we had blocked up Coach Puffer's Dodge so that the driving wheels were off the ground."
"We got some kind of shock, though. He gets his cigarette lit, and then he turns on the radio. That's another thing that used to drive us all fucking bug shit, the way he always listened to that rock and roll music like he was some kid instead of old enough to qualify for social fucking security. Then he put the tranny into drive. We didn't see it, because we were all hunkered down, so he wouldn't see us. I remember Sonny Bellerman was kind of laughing, and just before it happened, he whispers, 'They up, men?' And I whispers back, 'Your pecker's up, Bellerman.' He was the only one who really got hurt, you know, because of his wedding ring. But swear to God, those wheels were up. We had that Plymouth rear end 4 inches off the ground."
"What happened?" I asked. From the way the story was going, I thought I could guess.
"What happened? He pulled out, just like always. That's what happened. Just like all four wheels was on the ground. He spun gravel and ripped that rear bumper out of our hands and pulled about a yard of skin off with it. Took most of Sonny Bellerman's third finger. His wedding ring got caught under the bumper, you know, and that finger popped off like a cork coming out of a bottle. And we heard LeBay laughing as he went out, like he knew all along we was there. He coulda, you know, if he'd gone back to use the bathroom after he finished shouting at Poochie, he coulda looked right out the window while he whizzed and seen us standing around behind the building waiting for him. Well, that was it for him and the Legion. We sent him a letter telling him we wanted him out, and he quit. Just to show you how funny the world is, it was Sonny Bellerman who stood up at the meeting right after LeBay died and said we ought to do the right thing by him just the same. 'Sure,' Sonny says. 'He says the guy was a dirty son of a bitch, but he fought the war with the rest of us, so why don't we send him off right?' So we did. I don't know. I guess Sonny Bellerman's a lot more of a Christian than I'll ever be."
"You must not have had the back wheels off the ground," I said, thinking of what had happened to the guys who had screwed around with Christine in November. They had lost a lot more than some skin off their fingers.
"We did, though," McCandless said. "When we got sprayed with gravel, it was from the front wheels. I've never to this day been able to figure out how he pulled that trick off. It's kind of spooky, like I said. Jerry Barlow, he was one of us who did it, always claimed LeBay threw a four-wheel drive into her somehow, but I don't think there's a conversion kit for something like that, do you?"
"No," I said. "I don't think it could be done."
"No, never do it," McCandless agreed. "Never do it. Well, hey, I done jawed away most of my coffee break, kid. Want to get back and grab another half a cup before it all gets away from me. I'll send you that address if we got it. I think we do."
"Thank you, Mr. McCandless."
"My pleasure, Dennis. Take care of yourself."
"Sure, use it, don't abuse it, right?"
He laughed.
"That's what we used to say in Fighting Fifth, anyway."
He hung up. I put the phone down slowly and thought about cars that still kept moving even when you lifted their driving wheels off the ground. Sort of spooky. It was spooky, all right, and McCandless still had the scars to prove it. That made me remember something George LeBay had told me. He had a scar to show from his association with Roland D. LeBay as well. And as he grew older, his scar had spread.
Chapter 45, New Year's Eve. I called Arnie on New Year's Eve. I'd had a couple of days to think about it, and I didn't really want to do it. But I had to see him. I had come to believe I wouldn't be able to decide anything until I actually saw him again for myself. And until I had seen Christine again. I had mentioned the car to my father at breakfast, casually, as if in passing, and he told me that he believed all the cars that had been impounded in Darnell's garage had now been photographed and returned. Regina Cunningham answered the phone, her voice stiff and formal.
"Cunningham residence?"
"Hi, Regina, it's Dennis."
"Dennis!"
She sounded both pleased and surprised. For a moment, it was the voice of the old Regina, the one who gave Arnie and me peanut butter sandwiches with bits of bacon crumbled into them. Peanut butter and bacon on stone ground rye, of course.
"How are you? We heard that they sprung you from the hospital."
"I'm doing okay," I said. "How about you?" There was a brief silence, and then she said,
"Well, you know how things have been around here."
"Problems," I said. "Yeah."
"All the problems we missed in earlier years," Regina said. "I guess they just piled up in a corner and waited for us."
I cleared my throat a little and said nothing.
"Did you want to talk to Arnie?"
"If he's there."
After another slight pause, Regina said, "I remember that in the old days, you and he used to swap back and forth on New Year's Eve, seeing the new year in. Was that what you were calling about, Dennis?"
She sounded almost timid, and that was not like the old full-steam-ahead Regina at all. "Well, yeah," I said. "Kid stuff, I know, but..."
"No," she said sharply and quickly. "No, not at all. If Arnie ever needed you, Dennis, needed some friend, now's the time. He's upstairs now, sleeping. He sleeps much too much, and
Hasn't what, Regina?"
"He hasn't made any of his college applications," she burst out, and then immediately lowered her voice, as if Arnie might overhear. "Not a single one. Mr. Vickers, the guidance counselor at school, called and told me. He scored 700s on his college boards. He could get into almost any college in the country. At least, he could have before this. This trouble."
Her voice wavered toward tears, and then she got hold of herself again.
"Talk to him, Dennis. If you could spend the evening with him tonight... drink a few beers with him and just talk to him."
She stopped, but I could tell there was something more, something she needed to say and couldn't. "Regina," I said. I hadn't liked the old Regina, the compulsive dominator who seemed to run the lives of her husband and son to fit her own timetable. But I liked this distracted, weepy woman even less. "Come on, take it easy, okay?"
"I'm afraid to talk to him," she said finally. "And Michael's afraid to talk to him. He seems to explode if you cross him on some subjects. At first it was only his car. Now it's college, too. Talk to him, Dennis, please."
There was another short pause, and then, almost casually, she brought out the heart of her dread.
I think we're losing him.
No, Regina, hey, I'll get him, she said abruptly, and the phone clunked down. The weight seemed to stretch out. I crooked the phone between my jaw and my shoulder and wrapped my knuckles on the cast that still covered my upper left leg. I wrestled with a craven urge to just hang the telephone up and push this entire business away. Then the phone was picked up again.
Hello?
A wary voice asked, and the thought that burned across my mind with complete assurance was, that's not Arnie.
Arnie? It sounds like Dennis Gilder, the mouth that walks like a man, the voice said,
and that sounded like Arnie, all right. But at the same time, it didn't. His voice hadn't really deepened, but it seemed to have roughened, as if through overuse and shouting. It was eerie, as if I were talking to a stranger who was doing a pretty good imitation of my friend Arnie.
Watch what you're saying, dork, I said.
I was smiling, but my hands were dead cold.
You know, he said in a confidential voice, your face and my ass bear a suspicious resemblance.
I've noticed the resemblance, but last time I thought it was the other way around, I said. And then a little silence fell between us. We had gone through what passed for the amenities with us.
So what are you doing tonight?
I asked.
Not much, he said. No date or anything. You?
Sure, I'm in great shape, I said. I'm gonna go pick up Roseanne and take her to Studio 2000. You can come along and hold my crutches while we dance if you want. He laughed a little. I thought I'd come over, I said. Maybe you and me could see the new year in like we used to, you know?
Yeah,
Arnie said. He sounded pleased by the idea, but still not quite like himself.
Watch Guy Lombardo and all that happy crappy. That'd be all right.
I paused for a moment, not quite sure what to say. Finally, I replied cautiously, well, maybe Dick Clark or someone. Guy Lombardo's dead, Arnie.
Is he?
Arnie sounded puzzled, doubtful.
Oh, yeah, I guess he is, but Dick Clark's hanging in there, right?
Right, I said.
I gotta give it an 85, Dick. It's got a good beat, and you can dance to it,
Arnie said, but it wasn't Arnie's voice at all. My mind made a sudden and hideously unexpected cross-connection.
Best smell in the world. Except maybe for pussy.
And my hand tightened down convulsively on the telephone. I think I almost screamed. I wasn't talking to Arnie. I was talking to Roland LeBay. I was talking to a dead man. That's Dick, all right, I heard myself say as if from a distance.
How you getting over, Dennis? Can you drive?
No, not yet. I thought I'd get my dad to drive me over. I paused momentarily, then plunged. I thought maybe you could drive me back if you got your car. Would that be okay?
Sure.
He sounded honestly excited.
Yeah, that'd be good, Dennis. Real good. We'll have some laughs, just like old times.
Yes, I said. And then, I swear to God, it just popped out. I added,
just like in the motor pool. Yeah, that's right,
Arnie replied, laughing.
Too much. See you, Dennis.
Right, I said automatically. See ya. I hung up and I looked at the telephone, and presently I began to shudder all over. I'd never been so frightened in my life as I was right then. Time passes, the mind rebuilds its defenses. I think one of the reasons there is so little convincing evidence of psychic phenomena is that the mind goes to work and restructures the evidence. A little stacking is better than a lot of insanity. Later, I questioned what I heard, or led myself to believe that Arnie had misunderstood my comment, but in the few moments after I put the telephone down, I was sure. LeBay had gotten in him. Somehow, dead or not, LeBay was in him, and LeBay was taking over. New Year's Eve was cold and crystal clear. My dad dropped me off at the Cunninghams at 7:15 and helped me over to the back door. Crutches were not made for winter or snow-packed paths. The Cunningham station wagon was gone, but Christine stood in the driveway. Her bright red and white finish sheened with a condensation of ice crystals. She had been released with the rest of the impounded cars only this week. Just looking at her brought on a feeling of dull dread like a headache. I did not want to ride home in that car, not tonight, not ever. I wanted my own, ordinary, mass-produced duster with its vinyl seat covers and its dumb bumper sticker reading Mafia Staff Car. The back porch light flicked on, and we saw Arnie cross toward the door in silhouette. He didn't even look like Arnie. His shoulders sloped. His movements seemed older. I told myself it was only imagination, my suspicions working on me. And of course I was full of bullshit, and I knew it. He opened the door and leaned out in an old flannel shirt and a pair of jeans.
"Dennis," he said, "my man."
"Hi, Arnie," I said.
"Hello, Mr. Gilder."
"Hi, Arnie," my dad said, raising one gloved hand. "How's it been going?"
"Well, you know, not that great. But that's all gonna change. New year, new broom, out with the old shit, in with the new shit, right?"
"I guess so," my father said, sounding a little taken aback. "Dennis, are you sure you don't want me to come back and get you?" I wanted that more than anything, but Arnie was looking at me, and his mouth was still smiling, but his eyes were flat and watchful. "No, Arnie will bring me home. If that rust bucket'll start, that is."
"Uh-oh, watch what you call my car,"
Arnie said. "She's very sensitive."
"Is she?" I asked. "She is,"
Arnie said, smiling. I turned my head and called, "Sorry, Christine."
"That's better."
For a moment, all three of us stood there. My father and I at the bottom of the kitchen steps, Arnie in the doorway above us, none of us apparently knowing what to say next. I felt a kind of panic. Somebody had to say something, or else the whole ridiculous fiction that nothing had changed would collapse of its own weight.
"Well, okay," my dad said at last. "You two kids stay sober. If you have more than a couple of beers, Arnie, call me."
"Don't worry, Mr. Gilder."
"We'll be all right," I said, grinning a grin that felt plastic and false. "You going home and get your beauty sleep, Dad. You need it."
"Uh-huh," my father said. "Watch what you call my face. It's very sensitive."
He went back to the car. I stood and watched him, my crutches propped in my armpits. I watched him while he crossed behind Christine, and when he backed out of the driveway and turned toward home, I felt a little bit better. I banged the snow off the tip of each crutch carefully while standing in the doorway. The Cunningham's kitchen was tile-floored. A couple of near accidents had taught me that on smooth surfaces, a pair of crutches with wet snow on them can turn into ice skates.
"You really operate on those babies,"
Arnie said, watching me cross the floor. He took a pack of Tipperillos from the pocket of his flannel shirt, shook one out, bit down on the white plastic mouthpiece, and lit it with his head cocked to one side. The match flame played momentarily across his cheeks like yellow streaks of paint.
"It's a skill I'll be glad to lose," I said. "When did you start with the cigars?"
"Darnell's," he said. "I don't smoke them in front of my mother. The smell drives her bug shit."
He didn't smoke like a kid just learning the habit. He smoked like a man who has been doing it for 20 years.
"I thought I'd make popcorn," he said. "You up for that?"
"Sure, you got any beer?"
"That's affirmative. There's a 6-pack in the fridge and 2 more downstairs."
"Great." I sat down carefully at the kitchen table, stretching out my left leg. "Where's your folks?"
"Went to a New Year's Eve party at the Fassenbachs. When's that cast come off?"
"Maybe at the end of January, if I'm lucky."
I waved my crutches in the air and cried dramatically,
"Tiny Tim walks again! God bless us, everyone!"
Arnie, on his way to the stove with a deep pan, a bag of popcorn, and a bottle of Wesson oil, laughed and shook his head.
"Same old Dennis. They didn't knock much of the stuffing out of you, you shitter."
"You didn't exactly overwhelm me with visits in the hospital, Arnie."
"I brought you a Thanksgiving supper. What the hell do you want, blood?"
I shrugged. Arnie sighed.
"Sometimes I think you were my good luck charm, Dennis."
"Off my case, hosehead."
"No, seriously. I've been in hot water ever since you broke your wishbones. And I'm still in hot water. It's a wonder I don't look like a lobster."
He laughed heartily. It was not the sound you'd expect of a kid in trouble. It was the laugh of a man, yes, a man, who was enjoying himself tremendously. He put the pan on the stove and poured Wesson oil over the bottom of it. His hair, shorter than it used to be, and combed back in a style that was new to me, fell over his forehead. He flipped it back with a quick jerk of his head and added popcorn to the oil. He slammed a lid over the pan, went to the fridge, got a 6-pack, slammed it down in front of me, pulled off 2 cans and opened them, gave me one, held up his, I held up mine.
"A toast,"
Arnie said.
"Death to the shitters of the world, 1979.
I lowered my can slowly.
"I can't drink to that, man."
I saw a spark of anger in those gray eyes. It seemed to twinkle there, like spurious good humor, and then go out.
"Well, what can you drink to, man?"
"About the college?" I asked quietly. He looked at me sullenly,
his earlier good humor gone like magic.
I should have known she'd fill you full of that garbage. My mother is one woman who never stuck at getting low to get what she wants. You know that, Dennis. She'd kiss a devil's ass if that's what it took.
I put my beer can down, still full. Well, she didn't kiss my ass. She just said you weren't making any applications, and she was worried.
It's my life,
Arnie said, his lips twisted, changing his face, making it extraordinarily ugly.
I'll do what I want.
And college isn't it?
Yeah, I'll go. But in my own time. You tell her that, if she asks. In my own time. Not this year, definitely not. If she thinks I'm gonna go off to Pitt, or Horlicks, or Rutgers, and put on a freshman beanie and go bula bula at the home football game, she's out of her mind. Not after the shitstorm I've been through this year. No way, man.
What are you gonna do?
I've taken off, he said. I'm gonna get in Christine, and we're gonna motivate, right the Christ out of this one-time table town. You understand?
His voice began to rise, to become shrill, and I felt horror sweep over me again. I was helpless against that unmanning fear and could only hope that it didn't show in my face, because it wasn't just LeBay's voice now. Now it was even LeBay's face, swimming under Arnie's like some dead thing preserved in formalin.
It's been nothing but a shitstorm, and I think that goddamn Junkins is still after me, full steam ahead, and he better watch out or somebody just might junk him.
Who's Junkins? I asked.
Never mind,
he said.
It's not important.
Behind him, the Wesson oil had begun to sizzle. A kernel of corn popped, punk, against the underside of the lid.
I gotta go shake that, Dennis. You want to make a toast or not? Makes no difference to me.
All right, I said. How about to us? He smiled, and the constriction in my chest eased a little.
Us? Yeah, that's a good one, Dennis. To us. Gotta be that, huh?
Gotta be. I said, and my voice hoarsened a little.
Yeah. Gotta be.
We clicked the bud cans together and drank. Arnie went over to the stove and began shaking the pan where the corn was picking up speed. I let a couple of swallows of beer slide down my throat. Beer was still a fairly new thing to me then, and I had never been drunk on it because I liked the taste quite well, and friends, Lenny Barong was the chief of them, had told me that if you got falling down, standing up, ralphing down your shirt shit-faced, you couldn't even look at the stuff for weeks. Sadly, I have found out since that isn't completely true. But Arnie was drinking like they were going to reinstitute prohibition on January 1st. He had finished the first can before the popcorn had finished popping. He crimped the empty, winked at me, and said,
"Watch me put it up the little tramp's ass, Dennis."
The illusion escaped me, so I just smiled noncommittally as he tossed the can toward the wastebasket. It banged the wall over it and dropped in.
2 points, I said. That's right, he said. Hand me another one, would you?
I did, figuring what the hell. My folks were planning to see the New Year in at home, and if Arnie got really drunk and passed out, I could give my dad a call. Arnie may say things drunk that he wouldn't say sober, and I didn't want to ride home in Christine anyway. But the beer didn't seem to affect him. He finished popping the corn, dumped it into a big plastic bowl, melted half a stick of margarine, poured it over the top, salted it, and said,
"Let's go into the living room and watch some tube. What do you say?"
Fine by me. I got my crutches, seated them in my armpits, which just lately felt as if they might be growing calluses, and then groped for the 3 beers still on the table.
"I'll come back for them," Arnie said. "Come on, before you break everything all over again."
He smiled at me, and for that moment, he was nobody but Arnie Cunningham, so much so that it broke my heart a little bit to look at him. There was some dorky New Year's Eve special on. Donnie and Marie Osmond were singing, both of them showing their giant white teeth in friendly but somehow shark-like grins. We let the TV play and talked. I told Arnie about the physical therapy sessions and how I was working out with weights, and after 2 beers I confessed that I was sometimes afraid that I would never walk right again. Not playing football in college didn't bother me, but that did. He nodded calmly and sympathetically through it all. I may as well stop right here and tell you that I have never spent such a peculiar evening in my life. Worse things were waiting, but nothing was so strange, so disjointed. It was like sitting through a movie where the picture is almost, but not quite, focused. Sometimes he seemed like Arnie, but at others he didn't seem like Arnie at all. He had picked up mannerisms I'd never noticed before, twirling his car keys nervously on the rectangle of leather to which they were attached, cracking his knuckles, occasionally biting at the ball of his thumb with his upper front teeth. There was that comment about putting it up the little tramp's ass when he tossed his beer can, and although he had gotten through 5 beers by the time I had finished my second, just downing them one after the other, he still didn't seem drunk. And there were mannerisms I had always associated with Arnie, which seemed to have disappeared completely. The quick, nervous pull at his earlobe when he was talking, the sudden stretch of his long legs ending with the ankles briefly crossed, his habit of expressing amusement by hissing air through his pursed lips instead of laughing outright. He did do that last once or twice, but more often he would signal his amusement in a string of shrill chuckles that I associated with LeBay. The special finished up at 11, and Arnie switched around the dial until he found a dance party in some New York hotel where they kept switching outside to Times Square, where a big crowd had already gathered. It wasn't Guy Lombardo, but it was close. "You really not going to college?" I asked.
"Not this year. Christine and I are going to head out for California right after graduation, at Golden Shore."
"Your folks know?" He looked startled at the idea.
"Hell no. Don't you tell them either. I need that like I need a rubber dick."
"What are you going to do out there?"
He shrugged. "Look for a job fixing cars. I'm as good at that as I am at anything."
And then he stunned me by saying casually,
"I'm hoping I can persuade Lee to come with me."
I swallowed beer the wrong way and began to cough, spraying my pants. Arnie slammed me on the back twice, hard.
"You okay?"
"Sure," I managed. "Just went down the wrong pipe."
"Arnie, if you think she's gonna come with you, you're living in a dream world. She's working on her college applications. She's got a whole file of them, man. She's really serious about it."
His eyes narrowed immediately, and I had a sinking feeling that the beer had betrayed me into saying more than I should have.
"How come you know so much about my girl?"
All of a sudden I felt as if I had been dropped into a long field that was full of loaded mines. "It's all she talks about, Arnie. Once she gets started on the subject, you can't shut her up."
"Chummy, you're not moving in, are you, Dennis?"
He was watching me closely, his eyes slitted with suspicion.
"You wouldn't do anything like that, would you?"
"No," I said, lying completely and fully. "That's a hell of a thing to say."
"Then how do you know so much about what she's doing?"
"I see her around," I said. "We talk about you."
"She talks about me?"
"Yeah, a little," I said casually. "She said that you and she had a fight over Christine." It was the right thing. He relaxed.
"It was just a little thing, just a little spat. She'll come around. And there are good schools out in California if she wants to go to school. We're gonna be married, Dennis. Have kids and all that shit."
I struggled to keep my poker face. "Does she know that?"
He laughed. "No way, not yet. But she will. Soon enough. I love her. And nothing's gonna get in the way of that."
The laughter died away.
"What did she say about Christine?"
Another mine. "She said she didn't like her. I think that maybe she was a little jealous." It was the right thing, again. He relaxed even more.
"Yeah, she sure was. But she'll come around, Dennis. The course of true love never runs smooth, but she'll come around, don't worry. If you see her again, tell her I'm gonna call, or talk to her when school starts again."
I considered telling him that Lee was in California right now, and decided not to. And I wondered what this new suspicious Arnie would do if he knew I had kissed the girl he thought he was gonna marry, had held her, was falling in love with her.
"Look, Dennis!"
Arnie cried, and pointed at the TV. They had switched to Times Square again. The crowd was a huge, but still swelling, organism. It was just past 11:30. The old year was guttering.
"Look at those shitters!"
He cackled his shrill, excited laugh, finished his beer, and went downstairs for a fresh six-pack. I sat in my chair and thought about Welch and Repperton, Trelawney, Stanton, Vandenberg, Darnell. I thought about how Arnie, or whatever Arnie had become,
thought that he and Lee had just had an unimportant lover's spat, and how they would end the school year getting married, just like in those greasy love ballads from the nifty 50s. And oh God, I had such a case of the creeps. We saw the new year in. Arnie produced a couple of noisemakers and party favors, the kind that go bang and then release a cloud of tiny crepe streamers. We toasted 1979 and talked a little more on neutral subjects, such as the Phillies' disappointing collapse in the playoffs and the Steelers' chances of going all the way to the Super Bowl. The bowl of popcorn was down to the old maids and the Bernie bottoms when I took myself in hand and asked one of the questions I had been avoiding. Arnie, what do you think happened to Darnell? He glanced at me sharply, then glanced back at the TV, where couples with New Year's confetti in their hair were dancing. He drank some more beer.
The people he was doing business with shut him up before he could talk too much. That's what I think happened.
The people he was working for?
Will used to say the Southern mob was bad, Arnie said, but that the Colombians were even worse.
Who are the...
The Colombians? Arnie laughed, cynically. Cocaine cowboys. That's who the Colombians are. Will used to claim they'd kill you if you even looked at one of their women the wrong way. And sometimes if you looked at her the right way. Maybe it was the Colombians. It was messy enough to be them.
Were you running coke for Darnell?
He shrugged.
I was running stuff for Will. I only whiffed coke for him once or twice. And I thank Christ that I didn't have anything worse than untaxed cigarettes when they picked me up. They caught me dead bang, bad shit. But if the situation was the same, I'd probably do it again. Will was a dirty, scuzzy old son of a bitch, but in some ways he was okay.
His eyes grew veiled. Strange.
Yeah. In some ways, he was okay. But he knew too much. That's why he got wasted. He knew too much. And sooner or later, he would have said something. Probably it was the Colombians. Crazy fuckers.
I don't get you. And it's not my business, I suppose.
He looked at me, grinned, and winked.
It was the domino theory. At least, it was supposed to be. There was a guy named Henry Buck. He was supposed to rat on me, I was supposed to rat on Will, and then the big casino. Will was supposed to rat on the people down south that were selling him the dope and the fireworks and cigarettes and booze. Those were the people the cops really wanted, especially the Colombians.
And you think they killed him?
He looked at me, flatly.
Them or the Southern mob, sure. Who else?
I shook my head.
Well, he said, let's have another beer and then I'll give you a lift home. I enjoyed this, Dennis. I really did.
There was a ring of truth in that, but Arnie never would have made a dorky comment like, I enjoyed this, I really did. Not the old Arnie.
Yeah, me too, man.
I didn't want another beer, but I took one anyway. I wanted to put off the inevitable moment of getting into Christine. This afternoon it had seemed a necessary step to sample the atmosphere of that car myself, if there was any atmosphere to sample. Now it seemed a frightening and crazy idea. I felt the secret of what Lee and I were becoming to each other like a large, breakable egg in my head.
Tell me, Christine, can you read minds?
I felt a crazy laugh coming up my throat and dumped beer on it. Listen, I said, I can call my dad to come and get me if you want, Arnie. He'll still be up.
No problem, Arnie said. I can walk 2 miles a straight line, don't worry.
I just thought,
I bet you're anxious to be able to drive yourself around again, huh?
Yeah, I am.
There's nothing finer than being behind the wheel of your own car, Arnie said.
And then his left eye slipped down in a bleary old roué's wink.
Except maybe pussy.
The time came. Arnie snapped off the TV, and I crutched my way across the kitchen and worked into my old ski parka, hoping that Michael and Regina would come in from their party and delay things yet a while longer. Maybe Michael would smell beer on Arnie's breath and offer me a ride. The memory of the afternoon I had slipped behind Christine's wheel when Arnie was in LeBay's house, dickering with the old son of a bitch, was all too clear in my mind.
Arnie had gotten a couple of beers from the fridge. For the road, he said. I considered telling him that if he got picked up DWI while he was out on bail, he'd probably go to jail before he could turn around. Then I decided I better keep my mouth shut. We went out. The first early morning of 1979 was deeply, clearly cold. The kind of cold that makes the moisture in your nose freeze in seconds. The snowbanks ringing the driveway glittered with billions of diamond crystals. And there sat Christine, her black windows called with frost. I stared at her, the mom.